Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host, Bruce Marable, CEO of the HR analytics dashboard company, Employee Cycle. And you know us, we help all of you struggling HR leaders out there that are pulling crappy spreadsheets from all your different HR systems and trying to turn it into some type of report. Well, we keep you from doing all that because that's just too much. And instead, we pull all your data using connectors to all your HR systems into one real-time, centralized, beautiful HR dashboard. But that's enough about me, because we have a very interesting guest and an amazing guest on our podcast today. Her name is Sarah Martin. She's the COO of WellCOA, which is the Wellness Council of America. And today we're going to talk about your employees don't care about your wellness program. Sarah, welcome to the podcast. Woo! Sarah Martin!
You know, it has been a long time since I've been greeted like that, Bruce. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if you ever need it throughout the day, just text me and I'll just call you.
I'm going to put you on my speed dial. I'll be honest.
There we go.
I need a lot of encouragement these days.
So, Sarah, thank you so much for carving out some time out of your busy schedule to be on the podcast. We all, meaning me and our entire audience, greatly appreciate it. But I have to ask you the question that we always ask, which is, how did you end up in the wonderful world of HR?
Great question. I'm going to be super brief because it's kind of a heady, in some ways deeply sad story, but I'm going to be brief about it. But I grew up watching work be really emotionally violent for people. So namely, my dad, who worked outside of the home, my mom worked inside the home. So he was my dad was kind of the person who I watched in the world of work the most growing up. And his really toxic work environment that he was a part of, it was really contributed to a cycle that led to alcoholism and then some pretty severe drug use. And then ultimately that kind of spiraled into the loss of his freedom and his job and his family. And I was terrified of work. I remember thinking, I feel like the briefcase that he hauls, and that was when there were briefcases, he was like picking up what I thought was like 100 pounds worth of briefcase, it looked like, you know, and like dragging it out the door every day. And this was like probably when he really got in trouble with the law and things went really bad for him, was about the time that I needed to be picking a college major. So I was like, oh my gosh, like this can't be work. Like this can't be my life, you know, and I just became almost obsessed with work as wanting it so badly to be part of the solution for people, because I'd watched it be part of the problem with my dad. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do it yet. And I don't know what the right, you know, what the right barriers are that I need to try to remove for people. But eventually I want to, my work to be about helping work be part of the solution for people and also helping work be something that allows people to reach their full potential in their lives, as opposed to contributing to some sort of unraveling, which is what I had seen. And I guess it was motivated so much by my own fear, which I think is unfortunately what motivates a lot of us. And my purpose and my motivation have changed from fear to inspiration and purpose now. But that's how I ultimately got here. So when I went to graduate school, I studied the psychology of work. So the ways that humans interact with their environments is industrial at work, which is industrial organizational psychology. And I just wanted to figure out, you know, what are the things that are keeping people from reaching their full potential? And there's issues, of course, of diversity and inclusion that can really stand in the way of people reaching their full potential if they're being discriminated against at work. And then there was also this idea of wellness. And I think that really piqued my interest because I'd seen my father, especially from a mental health perspective, just be so unwell. And I was thinking, gosh, if we spend 90,000 hours of our lives at work as North Americans. And so work has to be able to contribute, as I've seen it contribute negatively, but it has to also be able to contribute positively. So what are the right cultures and environments that actually lead to more wellness. And that was my foray into wellness and HR. And I started my career actually in employee training, organizational development, but then quickly moved over to wellness. So I worked in HR at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. I was managing the wellness program there. So it was part of our total rewards structure in HR. So it was a benefit. And so we had 5,000 employees at Blue Cross in Tennessee. And then after that, I went on to manage more of our consulting products that are external facing. So at Blue Cross, we also worked with our group customers, obviously, on their wellness strategy. So did that next. And then ultimately, I don't know if you're going to ask a question about it, but kind of had a come to Jesus moment with myself about, was that work actually going to be solving the problem that motivated me to get into HR in the first place? And had a freak out and said, no, absolutely not. And that's how I ended up at Wellcoa. We can talk about that if you want, but that's how I got to HR. And I worked in that space for about 5 years or so before coming to Wellcoa and working with HR leaders around the country now on their wellness programs through our membership.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. So clearly there's a very deep and personal connection between where you are, how you got to HR, and working in wellness.
Yeah, it was always about people.
And that one stat, did you say that we spend 90,000 hours at work?
90,000. I think for Europeans, it's 80,000, which is interesting. But yes, 90,000 hours as North Americans at work.
That's a lot of hours.
Across our lifetime. I know.
As a data guy, I'm now thinking about what's the percentage of those 90,000 hours that are actually real work. This is busy work. But that's for a whole other podcast.
Does it have to be 90,000 hours or could it be half of that? And less water cooler talk. Sure.
Today, our topic is your employees don't care about your wellness program. But I think it's important for us first to talk about what is Wellcoa. And then we'll go into what exactly is wellness. And so many people are talking about it. And it's such a buzz term at this point. And we'll go into why employees don't care about it. Does that work for you?
That's perfect. Love that. So just very briefly, so Wellcoa is a nonprofit organization. We are based out of Omaha, Nebraska. We have been around for 30 years. So we actually predate the wellness industry boom. And our vision for wellness has always been to be a transformative force that improves the health and well-being of all working people. And we do that by being a professional organization for the industry. We're membership-based. So we work with professionals in HR to recognize their work and them as professionals, educate them, provide them with tools and resources, things that they need to make their lives easier as a professional organization. So knowing my audience, you know, like SHRM, for example, is the professional organization for HR professionals in general. So we are that for specifically professionals who are focusing on wellness. And so we do a lot of those same things that SHRM or HRCI would do for the broader HR space, but we do it for wellness professionals. So we ultimately are trying to help our members improve behaviors of their employees, improve the cultures of their organizations, and then in performance of their organizations through more wellness. And so that is what we do. We work with 5,000 member organizations nationally, and then we also have about 25,000 other organizations who subscribe to other kinds of things. So for example, we have a weekly newsletter, we have some free resources available to the general public, and about 25,000 other organizations outside of our membership interact with us in that way, or maybe they come to our summit, which I know we're going to talk about later. Yeah, so that is who we are.
Got it. And you just mentioned your summit, which is coming up in a few weeks. Can you tell the audience what the summit is all about and where it's being held?
Yeah, this is the good news. So our national summit, we've been doing this for about a decade now, and we rotate around the country. We have a home on the West Coast in San Diego. Every 3 years, we go there. Then we have we're looking for a home kind of central and then on the East Coast. So we are bringing, it's a professional summit for worksite wellness. It is TED style in the sense that pretty much everyone is a keynote. It's on the main stage and it allows us to really curate the kinds of information that we share and create an experience that's really, it's not the white tablecloth research type of conference. It's really inspiration, networking, excitement, lights, music, action, and a time for people who are really looking for more ideas, new ideas. They're looking for their people who are, I think one of the things I notice is that our members can be pretty lonely. The if you're dealing with wellness in your organization, the likelihood of someone else in your organization also managing that kind of program besides you is very low for most places. It's 1 to 2 people. And so it can feel super siloed and alone. So this is like one time of year that Wellcoa can provide our members to come to one location in person, hear from really inspiring thought leaders across motivational theory, employee engagement, wellness, you name it, stress management, stigma reduction, physical activity, nutrition, all the things that we care about as wellness professionals. But then also be in community with each other, which is so important and really important to me too. Hospitality is deeply important to me. So it's really a homecoming every year. People know that they can come and connect with their people. And this year, we are going to be in Philadelphia. So August. Woo-hoo! I know. So we're coming to the Lowe's Hotel in downtown Philly, and we hope that Philly will be our new home on the East Coast so that we'll come to you every 3 years with our summit. So that's why I wanted to connect with you and your network, because we would love for the Philly Summit to be special and really have the Philly flavor. And so, yeah, welcome. Come all, please. It's the end of August.
So now let's really dive into the topic and let's get right into what exactly is wellness? Is there a difference between wellness and corporate wellness? And ultimately, why don't employees care about the wellness program?
Yeah, great question. So you're so right about the conversation around wellness getting pretty muddied. It has, because the wellness industry is like $8 billion industry, and that covers anything from, yeah, corporate wellness to health spas and crystals and sandals and candles and all the things, right? So what we mean when we talk about wellness at work is, and Wellcoa has a definition of wellness to try to cut through some of this noise that we published that you can find on our website. And there's 7 dimensions of it. And really what it is for us, it is this idea that it's an active pursuit. So wellness is not just a thing that you achieve one time and it's done. We feel like it's an active pursuit to understand and fulfill your individual human needs. And the idea there would be that through doing that, you're going to be able to reach a state where you're truly flourishing and able to reach your full potential. And that's really important, because a lot of times I think, especially when we get really medicalized and clinical about it, or even health risks and lifestyle behaviors focused about it, we're talking a lot about broccoli and we're talking a lot about running, and we're not talking a whole lot about what actually makes people well. And what's really interesting about that is we know that through research on a woman named Alexandra Drain, who I follow really closely, Wellcoa follows really closely, did a study about 6 years ago. She calls the Unmentionables study, where she looked at the real reasons why people are not achieving wellness. And she looked at cholesterol, and she looked at nutrition, and she looked at sleep, and she looked at physical activity, and she looked at compliance with chronic care, preventative care, all of those things. And the startling finding that she came up with was that the things that actually make people well are not the things that anybody at work or anywhere else really wants to talk about. It wasn't how much exercise you were getting or how much broccoli you were eating or your cholesterol numbers. Those are all more outcomes of how well you are. It's a sign that something's going well for you, that you can care about your cholesterol, that you can care about running every day, that you can care about meal planning and eating balanced meals. That's a sign that you've reached a place where you're able to invest in your wellness. And what she found was that to actually be able to do that, you have to have a lot of other problems solved for you. The root causes of being well are things like having a really healthy sex life, not hating your boss, not hating your job. If you're caregiving for a child or for an aging parent, it's going to keep you from being well. If you're not getting enough sleep, if you're going through a divorce, if you're, any of those things, those were things that time after time people reported were actually the root cause of whether they were achieving wellness or not, which to me is a big whoa for the ways that we approach it in the wellness industry, And so we have to think, in order to solve the problems we're trying to solve, which are really important problems, declining health, increasing obesity rates, all of those things, we have to get really honest about how messy humans' lives are. And it's not so much that people don't want to be well. It's just that there's many, many barriers that people experience in their lives. Just the muck of life that is keeping them from engaging in those behaviors that we want them to engage in to be well. So our definition of wellness, that's a long-winded way of saying that our definition of wellness includes the declaration that every person has wellness aspirations and that we have to first know that and approach it from that perspective and consider that in our definition as we're approaching wellness initiatives at work or otherwise. And so the only other thing I'll add there is that there's seven areas of wellness that we think that all organizations should pay attention to. Yes, definitely just general health. So beyond the absence of mental and physical illness, really having this sense of strength and energy from both your body and your mind, but also a sense of meaning and purpose, safety, both psychological safety and physical safety, human connection. There's a lot of interesting research out there since you're a data head, a lot of interesting research out there around the impact of human connection on health. There was a study that really got to me, made me kind of weepy, actually. They took someone who was deeply cared for another, so a partner or a best friend, and they put them in a situation where they felt emotionally separated from that person. So that person engaged in a scenario that basically cut off that relationship, cut off access to that relationship to the participant. So ostracized them, made them hurt their feelings. So basically some social isolation from someone who you deeply care about. And then they ran that person through a functional MRI and looked at their brain behavior and saw that the patterns of activity in their brain didn't look any different from the pain that you would see when someone stumps their toe. The pain receptors, the activity in the brain looked like physical pain, but it was emotional pain. And so then the second iteration of that study was they gave people Tylenol and they tried to repeat the study, and the Tylenol changed the brain patterns and changed the pain, the way that pain was being experienced from emotional, from social, from a lack of social connectivity, just the same as it would manage a headache or an actual physical ailment. So you really can't separate social connectivity from health because it impacts our health in a measurable way. And we're just now scratching the surface, I think, on the impact of that. So, and then achievement is a part of our definition of wellness, growth as individuals and in our jobs, and then also resiliency. So this idea that you can view your life with optimism and you have gratitude for the things that you have and you're able to bounce back when things aren't going well for you. So that's what wellness is. And I'm speaking about it so long-windedly because I think people try to reduce it. And it's true that it would be reductive to say that it's something that you achieve once and that you achieve it through lifestyle behaviors and then you're done, because humans are just not that simple.
Wow. That was a lot.
Sorry.
That was awesome. That was the best, most well-defined definition of wellness I've ever heard.
That's a relief, because we would be really screwing up as the Wellness Council of Minnesota.
That was really interesting and deep. And I'm pretty sure a lot of listeners really now have a newfound understanding and perspective of what wellness means, especially when it comes to corporate wellness. So now that we've summed all that up, let's get into the topic about employees don't care about the corporate wellness program. Why not?
Yeah. So this is actually a great segue back to my little freak out. So I'll make it about me for a second. When I was at Blue Cross and I'd been there for several years and we were doing great work, I had to get serious with myself for a second and think, wait a minute, why are you here? Right? Like, I told you the story. Why did I end up at Blue Cross? Well, it's because I cared about making work part of the solution for people. I cared about, you know, making work something that helps you reach your full potential. And I did it to avenge my dad. And I had to ask myself, you know, is this program that I'm managing for our employees, would it actually have helped my dad? And if in the heat of everything that was happening to him, I'd come up to him and said, you know, we can help you. We have this wellness program. And I apologize for the hyperbole. It's a little more broad than this, but basically what it was, you did get your biometric screening, measure your biometrics. It's a finger prick. And then take this health risk assessment where we ask you all these questions about the risky behaviors that you have that contribute to poor health. And then we're going to tell you that you are hypertensive and you're an alcoholic. But then we are going to give you a $200 gift card to Target. You know, like,
that's hilarious.
But And it's hyperbolic for a reason, because there's so many resources that our wellness programs offer that are better than that. But that's really always the sentiment, is this idea that like, so wellness has to start with understanding what's wrong with you. And then hopefully if you know what's wrong with you, then you'll start caring about fixing it. And then we're going to incent you to care by giving you, you know, some sort of financial incentive, or in some places, a penalty on your insurance plan for not participating. And then that's what we do. And we do it assuming that people, that the number one most exciting thing that we can do is get employees to care about their health. But the thing is, employees already do care about their health. It's just really hard to maintain good health. The problem is we're not solving people's biggest problems. I mean, the answer to my question, would this have helped my dad, is absolutely no. He was at a place that scapegoated him and made him feel worthless and didn't ever really allow him to grow as a professional, and continued to slam doors on him in terms of achievement, and contributed to mental health issues, alcoholism, sickness. And if we're thinking about wellness as just a pattern of things that we're trying to get employees to do to be more well and to care about their health, we're going to continue to be lost because of, if you, you know, with the definition of wellness thing, that's not actually what people care about. At the end of the day, you have to reach some sort of self-actualization where everything else is going pretty well in your life for someone to come up to you and say, hey, do you want to be a part of this walking challenge? And you'd be like, oh, sure, that's cool. I got nothing else to do. I'll be a part of your walking challenge. And ultimately, I think if we're just thinking about wellness in a really limited way, and we're coming from the perspective that employees don't already care about their wellness, then we're going to continue to see a pattern of lack of engagement in our wellness programs. And I mean, we're all good social scientists here, and we know that my dad's story is a little n sample size equals one story, which is not a good sample size for drawing any conclusions. But we have data actually from Gallup and others that are actively researching this to try to get at, you know, do our employees care about our wellness programs? And what we know is that with organizations that have at least 1,000 employees, 85% of those employers that have at least 1,000 employees have some sort of wellness program in place. And then out of that, those 85% that have one, 60% of employees in an organization that have a wellness program actually know about it at all. So already we've lost 40% of employees who have never found it to be meaningful enough to even recognize that it exists. And then out of that 60% that know about it, only 40% of those participate. So that's bottom line, 24%. 24% of employees at companies that offer a wellness program actually participate. And so that should be pretty startling for us. Another way of looking at engagement is the National Business Group on Health, along with Fidelity Investments, did a study several years ago on incentives. If you're not familiar with this, we pay people on average about $500-$600 a year to participate in some sort of wellness program. And they wanted to understand the total value of those incentives. And they came up with this like number, some crazy number, like $47 million across the entire study population of hundreds of organizations of all sizes and types. And they published that research and always put that $47 million up on a slide when I give live keynotes and ask people what they think that total number is. And they always guess, oh, it must be the total amount of money paid out, you know, in incentives amongst that study population. And I always say, yeah, good guess, that would make sense, but it's not. It's actually the total amount of money paid out in the sample population that employees left on the table. So to translate, employers are trying to pay people to be well, and employees are saying, I do not care about your wellness program, and I honestly can't even care enough for you to pay me. Like, I don't care about the money either. And it's because you can't even pay me to care about your wellness program. And so that should make us all set up pretty straight. First of all, we're the only industry that I can think of whose products and services you have to pay people to consume. But then also it makes sense from a motivational perspective. You know, if I looked at you, if I gave you a glass of water and I was like, hey, Bruce, I'll pay you $5 to drink this water. You're going to be like, Sarah, what the heck is in the water?
Right. I would Sarah's trying to kill me. I'm never talking to Sarah again.
Right. She is trying to poison me to every inch of my life. Right. Because you are already thirsty. You're a human. You already desire water to live. You're already intrinsically motivated to drink water. But now I've made you very suspicious of the water I'm giving you. And so let's say you say, all right, great, I'm thirsty already. I'll take your $2 and you drink the water and I come back to you tomorrow and I just offer you a glass of water. You're going to be like, well, how much are you going to pay me? And we do that. And now, and so we know from, actually there's research on this, on motivational theory, that basically says if you pay people, it's called the overjustification effect. But if you try to motivate someone extrinsically for something they were already intrinsically motivated to do, like drink water, over time, it's going to kill their intrinsic motivation to do that thing. They're only going to focus on the extrinsic reward. It's going to make them want it less for themselves. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot. So it's kind of twofold then. Why don't your employees care about your wellness program? Because your wellness program might not be designed to actually solve your employees' problems that they care about right now. To be more well, you have to solve their biggest problems first. And then the other piece of it is that if we're paying them to be well, unfortunately, we're fighting a losing battle because one, they already care about their wellness, so we're wasting our time. And then we actually might do more damage than good because of what we know about the overjustification effect. So it's kind of, you know, what do employees care about? And how do you create wellness programs that are meaningful and engaging so that we can all meet our needs that we have? Because no one could say that double-digit increases in healthcare dollar spending isn't a problem, you know, for organizations. We still have the problem. The problem persists, but how can we continue to do a better job? And that's what WellCOA designs resources around. And that's what our summit's going to be about. And that's the problem that we're hoping to help our membership base solve.
So if we have this huge problem about awareness around wellness programs, adoption around wellness programs, but then also this problem way over here about reprioritizing which type of wellness we're providing, which it seems as though you've laid out in these seven areas of wellness, some including body and mind, safety, human connection. There seems to be a lot of stuff to do. So to make this as actionable as possible, what can all the HR leaders listening take from this?
Great question. Yeah. So most immediately, I would say if you've never heard of, so WellCOA has the seven benchmarks. It's a change management process with seven steps. Iterative steps that when done in order will create not just a wellness program, but really embed wellness into your organizational DNA. And it's step by step. It's just simple change management. And we train everyone on it. You can get some free training as a non-member. And then if you're interested, you can become a member and get even more in-depth training and resources on it. But basically what we're saying is it starts with understanding why wellness is important in your organization. There's so much great culture work that's happening that's not quote unquote wellness, but super meaningful because it makes sense to everybody. So I'll give you an example. You know, Patagonia, they are an outdoor company, right? Outdoor gear, and they're focused on that. And all their employees deeply care about the outdoor, getting outside as well. And so when you work for Patagonia, you know that that employer cares about being outside and being active, and that's a value. And you can easily align with that value so that if they ask you to do something like work extra hours because surf's going to be good the next day and they're going to let you off work to go surf because that's what they do, then you're going to show up and you're going to work however many extra hours because you know that we're all aligned here. We all know what we're doing. What we're trying to achieve here is more people being outside more and active more. And I care about that. My employer cares about that. Stakeholders in my company care about that. And I'm going to rise to whatever occasion because we're all aligned in our purpose. And so way too often we lead with something that no employee can get behind. So we come in with our wellness strategy and we say, hey, employees, you're expensive to insure. You're not healthy. I need you to help me help you. Our health plan is way too expensive. You can do something about it. We need to take ownership over your health and wellness. And that looks like eating more vegetables, exercising more, getting this finger prick, your biometric screening, managing your health risks, and talking to a health coach. And your employee says, I'm doing something for my employer that I really don't care about. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with why I chose to work here. And it's not really aligned with any other part of my experience as an employee in this organization. My employer is not saying, hey, we care about your health, so we're going to pay you an hour of time on the clock to work out in the middle of your workday. They're not saying that to me at all. They're not saying, hey, we care about your health, so we're going to make sure that you have a mindfulness hour or stress management on-site resource so that you can go to the mindfulness room and meditate because we care about you. They're saying, what it's your problem to figure out how to be well, and it's our problem that you're expensive to insure. So we got to figure out what to do about that. And there's just nothing compelling about that. So the very first thing that we do when we work with an organization is say, what is important to your organization? Are you an organization with a lot of crisis care workers that are burnt out a lot and your biggest problem is burnout? Well, have you been handling burnout through other kinds of cultural work? And is it possible that maybe, just maybe, you could create a wellness program that solves that problem? And that could be aligned across the entire organization, just the way that you guys operate? Or we're an employer that cares about our brand. We're a local bank and we have been investing in the community, trying to win business in this local bank or federal or this local credit union or whatever it is that we're doing. So one of our biggest goals is to be very community focused and present in the community. Could we use our wellness program to do that? Could we do walking challenges that involve the entire community led by our employees? Could we do wellness fairs, community wellness fairs or wellness events? Could we use wellness to solve our biggest problems, which is for us market share through stronger brands rooted in the community? And if we can structure our wellness strategies as organizations around those kinds of things, then it just becomes more meaningful. And your employees aren't going to raise their eyebrows and say, are you really just trying to drop me from your insurance plan? Are you really just trying to offload financial responsibility for my medical care onto me as the employee? Or does it feel like an organization initiative where everyone's trying to, you know, chart the same course to success? And once you know what that why, W-H-Y, is for wellness, then we just plug that into our model and you train you on how to create a program that will achieve that. And it's just very straightforward after that. So that's how we work with organizations, and we have organization-facing assessments that measure the extent to which you're doing that and give you targeted resources and tools. And we have an award where once you feel really great about what you've done, you can apply for national recognition as a well workplace. But I would say the place to start is learning about the benchmarks, because there's going to be a lot of aha moments. If you have a wellness program right now and you're banging your head against the wall because you're not getting the engagement that you want, that is the problem that we solve for our members.
Thank you so much for dropping all that knowledge and wisdom on all of our audience. That was great. That was great. You've changed my perspective of wellness with this one interview. So I am thrilled. We're going to go to my favorite part of the podcast, which I call the real, the random, and the ridiculous.
Oh boy. Those are three words that describe me. That's great. Let's do it.
All right. So the real question, do you like to eat bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
Oh my gosh. Okay, answer, yes, I love to eat bread pudding. That was the question, right? I'm like having second guesses.
Yes, That was the question. The question was, do you like bread pudding? That was not the random question. That was the real question. I am a bread pudding connoisseur, and I always like to know, what do all our guests, do they like bread pudding? Do they like how to eat it? How do they make it? This is research for me. So okay. Part of this podcast to just get a quick referral.
So I'm originally from the Southeast, so I'm from Alabama, and one of my favorite bread puddings is made with like Southern style bourbon cream sauce. So served warm, and you can actually make it out of like, you know, those King's Hawaiian rolls.
Yes, I do.
So flavor profile, I like the King's Hawaiian roll because it's a little sweet. I want cinnamon in my bread pudding. I want to eat it warm. I want to eat it with bourbon, like sweet bourbon glaze, and then a scoop of vanilla ice cream.
Wow. I might need to go get that right after this
interview. And I don't make it. I don't bake. I'm terrible. But I would love to. If someone brought me that, I would eat it. And can we just talk about raisins? Screw that. I don't want raisins. Keep the raisins out of my bread pudding. They're like creepy little bugs.
Creepy little bugs.
Infiltrating. Otherwise, it would be a perfect dessert.
That is the most amazing description of bread pudding and answer to this question. We're going to go on the highlight reel for sure. That's amazing. Okay, so the random question. Anna, who introduced us, she asked me if I could ask you about cars. I don't know what that is, but I know it was pretty random. So I don't know if you are a hardcore race driver or you race cars in your spare time, but she's okay. So here I am.
So that's great. Anna's awesome, by the way. We must have had a conversation about this. My first car, I got bitten by the muscle car bug, again, from the South. And so I grew up loving American Muscle, Chevrolet and Mopar. If you're familiar with Mopars, that Plymouth Dodge Chrysler. And so my first car was a 1978 Camaro. That I bought for $3,000 using money I'd saved. And over the course of several years, as I had money, I threw at it and I completely restored it and ultimately like entered it in car shows. So I won like top 10 at car shows. Like I have like trophies for my car. It was it was red. It had Kreger wheels, if anyone knows anything about cars. It had a Holley 650 carburetor. It was a 305, so not a huge engine, but big enough for a 16-year-old girl. A woman in the South. And I love to drag race. Don't tell my mother. There was a quarter mile strip behind my house that we used to race. And it was back when the Fast and the Furious movies were coming out and everybody was buying like 4-cylinder cars and like souping them up. And that annoyed me to no end. So I loved smoking those cars in a quarter mile. They could top out faster than me, but no one could smoke me in a quarter mile. So unfortunately that I was in a car accident and totaled the car. Got all my teeth knocked out, kind of crazy. You can't tell by looking at me. They're all dental work in modern dentistry is incredible. But I always say I've never been completely happy since I could smoke you in a quarter mile. One day I'm going to have another muscle car. I don't know if it'll be a Camaro. I think I'm going to get a GTO or maybe a Barracuda or Hemi Cuda to get into the Mopar world. But I do love cars.
So you were the Vin Diesel muscle car driver.
I really was. I was. And it worked out great for me. People thought it was just so cool. I had a racing fan, which had a switch on the dashboard. No one knew what the switch was for. And I used to tell them it was NOS. Definitely
was
NOS.
That's hilarious.
But anyway, so that's probably the car story that Anna wanted me to share with you.
Well, when the conference comes and if I see anybody just flying down Broad Street, I know. Yeah, all good.
I've been so I'm too tame these days, Bruce. I need to get bitten by that bug again for sure.
Okay. That was awesome. And then the ridiculous question. Okay. What do you think is the most ridiculous thing about the wellness industry today?
I feel like it has to be that we're paying people to be well. I mean, I know we already talked about it, but we've lost sight of what it means to be human when we think that humans don't want to thrive. You know, like, if people just care about their health, you know, there's a study that's like, human behavior is the leading cause of death. It's like, cool. But like, so it's like, what are we supposed to take away from that? Like that everyone just got together one day and decided to start making terrible decisions, mm-hmm. You know, like, or is there something else maybe going on? Like the environments in which we're making those decisions and how hard it is to make good decisions in the environments that we're in, you know? And so that I always get a chuckle out of that. Here's another one. Here's one I didn't mention. So wellness, because as you mentioned, it's a muddy term. No one knows exactly what it means. Wellness in corporate America got a bad rep because it was this like punitive thing where we're asking employees to get biometrics and doing all these things. And it wasn't cute. And it wasn't sexy. And employees are like, ew, wellness. Are you trying to big brother me? What is this? So what did we do? We changed the word. Now it's like, oh, we don't do wellness anymore. We do well-being. And it's like, oh, okay. What is that? They're like, that means it's holistic. And you're like, okay, great, that's fine. But like, what does the program actually look like? Like you can call it, you know, tomato salad if you want to, I don't care. Like, do people like it? Is it helping them? You know, I don't care what you call it, as long as we're treating humans like humans and we're managing our programs with this kind of view that there's a sanctity to human life and choosing, and that our job is to partner with our employees to help them be successful. And I don't care what, if you call it health or wellness or well-being, but just kind of funny that it was like, oh, we screwed that word up. Let's just get a new word. You know, like instead of kind of going back to the point that we deviated and seeing how we can do a better job with wellness.
Got it. This was one of my favorite and most fun, entertaining episodes. Sarah, thank you so much for being a guest on the Employee Cycle Podcast. Thank you, Sarah.
This is a very fun podcast. Thank you so much. Yeah, Philadelphia is lucky to have you. This is really cool. So thank you so much for having me on. And I hope that I'll see you in Philly, hopefully. And I hope that all of your listeners will come to. So just go to Welcoa, WELCOA.org, and you can learn all about our summit. And hopefully you'll come see us when we're there in Philly in August.
Okay, great. And can you just let us know where people can find you and Welcoa online?
Yeah, so it's welcoa.org. So WELCOA.org. And so from there, you can find information about the summit. And then if somebody wants to reach out to me, if you go to About and go to our staff page, my email address is right there. And you can find me and shoot me a note or hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm Sarah Martin Rausch, R-A-U-C-H on LinkedIn, but Martin's perfect. And so I'm happy to answer any questions you have. And I would love for you to come shake my hand when you're at summit. I'll be behind the AV booth. So come find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, thank you all for joining the podcast and listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating. Really would appreciate it. Also, if this is your first time listening to the Employee Cycle podcast and you're not a subscriber, make sure you go to your favorite podcast player and subscribe to the Employee Cycle podcast. And you know what I'm about to say, HR leaders. Please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks again. Later, kids.